Welcome to the podcast of the Urban Mystic, the show focused on helping people understand and develop a practice of the presence of God so that they can shift from a relationship characterized by faith and distance to a deep, nurturing, and fulfilling relationship characterized by mutual desire and closeness. This podcast is for anyone who wants an intimate relationship with God. This includes church-going Christians, church leaders and volunteers, and those who consider themselves to be spiritual but not religious. If you enjoy this episode, I invite you to like the episode and leave a comment, to subscribe on your favorite podcast provider, and to contribute to the work of the Urban Mystic by following the link to PayPal in the show notes or the QR code on our website. This week we begin an exploration of intimacy in relationship with ourself, others, and God. We're looking for a congruence between each and reciprocity, meaning mutual engagement comprising self-discovery and self-revelation. Over the rest of the season, we'll be exploring the ways in which faith and intimacy connect and disconnect. We're encouraging a shift from the faith as relationship paradigm towards faith encouraging relational pursuit and union with God. Well, Steve, it's good to be back here with you tonight for another exploration on this journey we're on, the exploration of intimacy with God and the construction of, I guess, a theology and practice of spirituality that's centered on intimacy with God. On this journey to get there, it seems to be that we keep running into a number of challenges when it comes to speaking about intimacy with God. And I don't know about your experience of this, but I carry on having people throw things back at me. And I continuously get challenged on this topic and on this subject. And so in our typical fashion of having a pre-conversation ahead of this, you and I were chatting. The lot has fallen to me to provide some kind of summary to kick us off. And I think especially you tonight, since this is very much your realm of expertise. But when we think of intimacy, I guess it's not just a nice to have, but it's a basic building block for every individual, that every healthy human being has at the core of their experience, healthy, intimate relationships. And I think if we go a step further, I just binge-watched a series on Hulu called The Act, which is about, you know, a child who's the victim of Munchausen by proxy, and it gets all complicated, and someone gets murdered, and, you know, someone as well who's compromised, like mentally and socially within themselves, gets dragged into it and all of that. And when I think of those kind of things, I think of people who are compromised on a intimate level. They're compromised from the start of their life on a relational level that produces a tremendous amount of trauma and dysfunction in them, which significantly impacts their relationships with other people. When we think about people who are really healthy and well-adjusted and generally doing well in life and having good relationships, we can often track back in their life that they've had healthy, intimate relationships, that those have been a good foundation for them. And so when we think about that, intimacy is not something that we really have with things or that we have with broader society. It's a thing that takes place between persons, and that intimacy matters, and it matters in many different ways to people. It's a fundamental part of the human-to-human relationship, the human's relationship with themselves, the human's relationship with the significant others around them. And it's really important and vital for people. It's not just an optional extra. It's a vital component of any person-to-person relationship. And so to relate to God by faith is to relate to a concept that we construct by faith. It's to relate to an idea. It's not inherently an interpersonal relationship. Interpersonal relating may take around that, but the primary relationship for many people can be a faith relationship as opposed to an intimate relationship. So you were saying earlier and highlighting is that if it's very important for humans and it's very important in a human-to-human relationship, then it's really important in the human relationship with the divine. And so starting with that is a bit of a big picture of where we can go tonight and what we're going to explore. And that will set us up for a number of other conversations in the similar ballpark that really help guide us and take us toward intimacy with God by clearing some of the foundations and providing some foundations for us.
It's so interesting because as I take kind of check in quickly with myself as I listen to you and you pass the mic over to me, I notice, wow, I'm feeling really nervous about this topic. Yeah, I just notice I'm feeling really on edge. I think partly what that signifies to me is just how important I feel this for myself. And I think that would be the first most accurate statement, how important it is for me. And then a sense, secondary level, that it is an important thing to kind of get right as we talk about it. It's really, really, it's so vital. It's so crucial. It's neither of those words really scratch where it itches for me. It's a non-negotiable. It is something that is, you can't remove that from the human experience to experience intimacy. And when I say that, I think it can sound a little bit sometimes like still like it's a satellite to the core of what it is to be human, but I think it's not. It's right there in the nucleus to experience myself at a deep level, to have intimacy, closeness, interconnectedness with myself, then with someone else, someone's else, because it also gets quite complex quite quickly, is a need, is a universal human need. I think partly what makes me nervous about it is that intimacy has kind of like can almost be seen as like an extremist term in a way. It's kind of love and belonging at the other end of the spectrum. Because I would say love and belonging is a universal human need, and intimacy is a amplified expression of love and belonging. Because I can experience love and belonging with people that I'm not intimate with. And I think I'd also want to come back and qualify intimacy. You mentioned it earlier in terms of, I think we could also, that's also a bit of my nerves, we can also often only think of intimacy as kind of physical, sexual intimacy. It's that sort of clothes off, touching each other kind of thing. And I'll come back to that as well. But I can have friendships, which I would say are kind of, you know, just over the fence acquaintanceship or acquaintances rather. Friendships that are nice, enjoyable, fun. I get something out of it. I experience love and belonging in them. But love and belonging is a bit of a spectrum. It's not just a single point. And so I can experience a degree of love and belonging within a friendship in which I may not feel completely seen or heard, or trust to feel completely seen or heard, or trust to reveal so that I might be completely seen or heard. But as you push into love and belonging, I think the trajectory is intimacy. And so if I say that, and then I put next to that my sense that to not experience intimacy, I think is a painful thing for human beings to experience. And I think to not experience that in your life is to suffer a great lack. And I think we see that with people who have relationships to some degree of superficiality, but don't, for whatever reason, manage to push through into, yeah, I find myself wanting to say true intimacy. And I think that's partly what makes me a bit nervous here, because I want to stay away from this idea of like black and white, it's on or it's off, it's happening or it's not. It is really, there's a range here and there are degrees at which we can experience this. And I think what I'm excited about in that is that intimacy is not a destination that you can arrive at. Intimacy can continue to grow and evolve and deepen. And that is a function of two chief relationships, I think, to start with. The first is the me to myself, the eye to eye relationship. That can, as far as we know, there are no depths to that. That's a well that has no bottom that you can keep going into. Because of that, the I to you, the me to other relationship, also, I think, that is a well that has no bottom to it, because that is a function of two individuals with their own unique eye to eye, me to me relationship, interrelating with each other, and that there is a depth there that is incredibly nuanced, subtle, complex, beautiful. And so true intimacy is a little bit of, I think, a little bit misleading, in that true intimacy is something that I would rather describe as, I say a lot to the people I work with at the moment, the clients with which I work, it's less an expression of can we be healthy, it's more an expression of can we be healthier and healthier and healthier. It's trajectory language, it's process language, and I would want to stay away from destination oriented. Can you be intimate or not? And I think that's where then I find kind of the confusion within sort of the physical, the sexual, because then we would talk about, I was intimate with this person, which signifies now I'm intimate, now I'm not, as if it's somewhere that we can go and inhabit and then leave. And I think we can express a certain kind of intimacy in that way, and we cannot be expressing that intimacy, i.e., sorry to be crude, but if you're not having sex all the time, then you're not expressing that intimacy. I'm talking 24/7, right? 365. There are times when it's expressed and times when it's not. In the same way that to have physical touch intimacy, you hold somebody's hand or you don't. You give them a hug or you don't. There's an expression, a manifestation of that. And even that is not destination oriented, because that can grow in its expression over time. It's also, it's very helpful, I think, perhaps to just have this view of it is something that is process, that's a trajectory. It's something that we tend towards rather than ever arrive at. But it's one of those great paradoxical things where we can both arrive at it and never arrive, sort of horizon oriented in a way. And it's vital. And people who don't experience it, I think, note it, especially if they're able, willing to engage in a conversation in which there is this kind of moment of, do you experience intimacy? Oh, okay, what is that? No, actually, I don't think I have experienced that yet, to whatever degree. And you do, I think, come up against a pain response, however that manifests. It can be avoidance, it can be complete shutdown, it can be anger, it can be deep sadness, it can be all sorts of things, but I think that there's a pain response in that. When people note, I have not been able to go that far, that deeply within myself, and to have that with another person. And it had me thinking, I think it's the same in the divine, the me to divine, the I to the divine relationship. I would think it's probably a similar blueprint. And that's more of a theoretical statement, while at the same time, at a very personal experiential level, I feel that too, a desire for intimacy on those three levels. Me with someone else, me with the divine other. I feel a desire to experience greater love and belonging, to tend towards intimacy in those three areas. I think partly also when I'm trying to really approach it carefully is because for me, I would want to be clear that this is not a, you know, me, Steve, I really want this, therefore it must be something that is real for me and then for everyone else. It's not, you know, I have a need for this, therefore, what am I trying to say? I'm battling a bit with the words. It's kind of it's not a crutch thing. It's not that there's a deficiency in me, therefore I need to fill that gap with this support thing, I don't need a crutch. I'm not deficient in some way that intimacy will allow me to manage or cope. It's not an add-on to kind of keep me together. It's not I think of that, I guess, the crutch, because people often talk about, but religion's just a crutch. If you can get rid of that, then you can be truly okay. It's the other way around.
I think you're touching on something incredible there, because one of the things that I often hear said is that people go to the attachment stuff. Those that didn't experience good intimacy when they were born and in their early childhood, they've got a deficiency within themselves. When they get into their teenage years, into adulthood and life, you see them behaving badly in relationships. And what they're really trying to do is they're trying to fill that hole in them, try to fill what's missing within their identity, within their self-image, et cetera, through intimacy and through chasing intimacy, you know, particular markers. And people do look at religion and say it's the same thing. And nuanced within, you know, the circles we're in, we've both heard those accusations that people that are broken in that way are projecting an unfulfilled need or relationship from their childhood, either into their romantic relationships as adults or into their faith relationship with God. And then God becomes a, you know, faith is the imprint in your clothes. You know, God's whatever you make of it. So if you've got enough faith, God's there for you. And so you pull the wool over your own eyes and you meet that need within yourself through this fictitious God idea on a level. I'm hearing you kind of touch on that. Am I hearing you?
That's helpful. Oh, that's so helpful because, see, the opposite of essentially what I hear you describing, having an attachment disorder, the opposite is not to have no attachment. Well, the way out is not to have no attachment. It's not to experience love and belonging. It is to understand the wiring that is crossed, to use a poor metaphor, but perhaps simple enough just for now. The wiring that is crossed that gets in the way of deep and fruitful relationship. So it's not to then go, oh, okay, well, then I should not have this thing. It's, oh, actually, I need a healthy version of this thing because I did not have the healthy version of this thing. And by that, what we mean is the bedrock statement is, this is a required thing. This is a non-negotiable. This is fundamental to what it means to be human. It is to arrive on this planet and be nurtured within an atmosphere of love and belonging, where we are able to experience the giving and receiving of love and belonging in a sort of very present tense experiential sense, but also that which then provides us with a blueprint for what it is to be human, how to attach healthily to me and to someone else. And I really like that's so helpful how you put it. The answer is not, oh, you're deficient, there's something broken in you. Real people don't attach, that's what's wrong. No. Real people attach healthily in healthier and healthier ways because the experience of love and belonging, and as it tends towards intimacy, is a fundamental part of what it is to be human. And that's where we notice where the lack is, the pain response, and the different manifestations of you know, what we now to an extent understand as attachment disorders. That's helpful how you put it like that.
You know, the way you describe that, I feel for me reflects some of my journey in life and what I'm in recent years really trying to practice that ends up being really hard. And it's especially hard in the context where people kick back against it. And they do in various ways around the faith stuff. But, you know, my early years were characterized by severe neglect and abandonment. And then the dual experience of growing up in a system, which is institutional relating, which is not love and acceptance. Everything is conditional and it's impersonal. You know, it's fulfillment of like a social responsibility to provide for the poor and orphans, you know, rather than it's not a loving, nurturing relationship. The foundation isn't love and belonging. The foundation is you here within the system where you'll use these words like house parents or home, but they're not your home. They're not your parents. You can never have this. And I severely internalized that. So the way I managed that was through non-attachment. I didn't need what these other pathetic people needed when they needed parents. I didn't need that. Look how strong I am. And that carried through, I think, for a few years in my adult life. You know, those few years covering your 30s and most of your 40s and your 20s.
Yeah, just one or two years, pretty much. Most of the adulthood resonates too deeply with me, yes.
So pretty much most of my life, really. And I got to the place where I was really cornered, and I realized that in my adult life, I wasn't having successful, intimate, healthy, reciprocal relationships. I could neglect myself and show up wonderfully in relationship with others. But the minute I had a need, I felt firstly that I'd be abandoned. If I ask for something, I ask for too much, it's never going to be met. And that was actually reinforced that when people came to understand that I had trauma and this kind of stuff, it would actually lead to rejection and abandonment. So that's the experience for most of us. And for me, the challenge of moving from an unhealthy experience to trying to be in the position where I wasn't running away, denying or fighting against healthy experiences, but just being in them and letting them renew and inform me of what healthy experience is, has been a ridiculously confusing journey because I don't know. You know, so on a level, even though I speak about this thing of saying, hey, all about entering into deeper living and loving. for me, it's really, yeah, I'm about that, but I struggle to really define what that is. And when people kick back and say to me, the things that you put on the table, yeah, you're looking for the extreme version of it. You're just looking for one thing or another, and it looks like this, it looks like that. I'm saying I'm actually not. I'm not responding out of lack. I'm responding out of actually being, you know, quite a successfully functioning, emotionally mature, aware individual. Also, I believe, but I'm quoting people that have told me that. So I'll give you their names and numbers, and you can go and tell them otherwise if you believe otherwise. but really, what you're saying there when you speak of things of we don't move from a lack of love to a place of non-attachment and not needing it. We don't move from a place being a traumatized person who doesn't understand belonging and doesn't understand love. You don't move from that to never needing it and to non-attachment. I think we can spiritualize that way. And a lot of our spirituality is wired that way. And I see a lot of that being put forward in the faith or the spiritual box. You know, that agape is the true love. You can't have a human need where you've got a desire for someone or you want nice things, you know, for instance. You know, which is where a lot of the ministry stuff, or at least the early ministry stuff for me worked, because my home wasn't my home. You know, it's something that God gave me for service. My income wasn't my income. It's something that God provided for service, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so there's the way in which traumatized people can often just consistently be leaving themselves out. And I've done that. The last several years have been particularly challenging because I'm trying to do this exact thing that you say. You don't go from a lack of supportive nurturing and intimacy to never needing it. You discover that you do need it. You just struggle to figure out how to have it because you actually don't know how to have it. And then when you get it, you don't know how to trust it. So there's a lot of things here that ends up being quite intense. And yet I repeat this over and over with people that I work with and I engage these days, because I realize more and more that talk therapy doesn't solve this for people. The challenge of entering into love and belonging is a somatic embodied experience. You have to do it as a person in relationships. And you've got to do that as a person in relationship to yourself and take primary responsibility for that. And that is the capacity that you have to do it with others. That's what I'm discovering.
I like that.
And so one of the ways that I've been going about doing that is starting to recognize, like, what did I not get as a child that I gave up without wanting for myself? Whether it's watching an anime series, whether it's starting to draw again. I've been drawing again. Some disturbing stuff, cool. I'll let you know. Some healthy stuff too. There's some talent in there, perhaps even. And then recently I watched an anime series that I didn't get to finish as a child because my life got so disrupted. And it's always, I got to realize that that was a defining thing. And so there's ways in which I'm going about building myself, building my relationship with myself by trying to note that and then noting how this unfulfilled aspect of me consistently hamstrings my adult-to-adult relationships, not in a working environment where I'm not attached. I can go into any fields, or at least I've gone into several fields in my life and I do really well in them. But when it's personal to me, like my calling or a relationship with a deep, intimate other, I trip up because of these things and it's difficult to find the way through it. And I would think that if anyone said to someone in this case, you've been highly traumatized in your life, forget adult relationships. No one's ever going to love you. You've got to learn to do without. I wonder what we would think of that as a therapist, a psychologist, a supporting professional, just an adult other in your life saying that to you. I think we'd be horrified by that. And yet when it comes to spirituality, I feel that's what we're being told. And it just becomes quite a mess. So sorry, I mean, something in what you were saying there really related to me personally. And I thought I'd just go there if that's okay.
It's so interesting. I find myself somewhat sort of pseudo embodying a listener as I sit and listen. And I find that sort of like that there's a really beautiful element to, we talk quite a bit theoretically, but that personal element is really special because it reminds me that this is all personal, actually. I have a desire for this myself. I want intimacy with myself. I want intimacy with other human beings. I want intimacy with the divine. And I notice the pain response when I don't get that. And so I'm really touched by your taking it personally there, taking us to that point with your story and for sharing what you share, because I think it's a risk at some level. And I really solidly believe all relationship is risk. But it just reminds me, it's your personal story touches mine. And I realize, yeah, I'm also a traumatized individual trying to be a full adult, trying to enter deeply into living and loving. And that is also process, trajectory. There's also an orientation. It's also a journey rather than a destination. Some of those are so cliched, but it is so important to hold on to that because I am also a deeply wounded child who had moments where I did not experience love and belonging, did not have intimacy, also experienced neglect, abandonment, and that alters the blueprint for what I understand love and belonging, which then intimacy is. And I realize part of this is my coming home to myself, which is a deep, a really intimate, a really important statement for myself. I use the language of coming home to myself. It means a lot to me. But what it means is I'm also in this healing process of being able to be more at home with myself, to be more deeply connected within myself, to experience intimacy within myself. That's a very challenging thing and is immediately a gift to myself. Not because I want it like I want, you know, I don't know, $1 million. I want it because I notice it is fundamental to me being human, to me being fully alive, to entering into living deeply, to loving deeply, and is also actually the gateway, the vehicle into doing that with another, because I am the vehicle through which I participate in intimacy with another. And therefore, to an extent, I am the vehicle, I really believe I am the vehicle with which I participate in intimacy with the divine other. And I want to be careful when I say that because it can sound very kind of, for me, it can sound too similar to that, like, if you know that phrase, or if you feel far away from God, guess who moved? You know, that judgmental kind of, you're the broken link, you're the idiot, you break, it's yours at fault. That's not what I would be trying to say, but I would notice I am only able to go with another as far as I'm able to go with myself. I can con myself, I can fake it, whatever, but it's just not true. It's not intimacy. If I'm not able to be intimate with myself, it's very hard to be intimate with another, and it is an obstacle to intimacy as it is an obstacle to intimacy with the divine other. And that's not a judgment, that's not a limitation. It's to notice that. It's a level, I find, of awareness to notice, oh, as I am able to go further with me, I'm able to go further with you. There's an opportunity. I'm able to go further with the divine mother because I am the vehicle. I am the connection. And that also is not meant to express both sides of the relationship. Absolutely not, because that is the beautiful nature of the dynamic of the mutual reciprocity of the relationship, is that what happens in another that then impacts me, touches me, can move me further, can influence me, can guide me, can prompt me, can you know, also hurt me, can do a number of different things. But, you know, this is not an island in this, to coin that phrase, I am not isolated. This is not a process in and of itself just within me. It is this beautiful becoming in a relationship that takes, you know, two sides, two vehicles, that in a way I picture in my mind a relationship is something that happens both in each individual partner and somehow mystically between. They build almost this third mystical thing that we call the relationship that is both embodied in each and somehow is this intangible connection between the two. So it's not just about me. It's also about the other. But I have to notice, for me, I am the vehicle that I am connected with in terms of what it is to go deeper. So that really, that's kind of what that stimulates in me. I think, like, this is so personal because it is truly fundamentally what it means to be a person. That is how it can be personal. It is within me. It's not some great theoretical wonderment. It's not some, it's not some bullshit book or some rubbish out there. It's really, it's within me. When I settle down, I notice, oh, I need to belong to feel loved. I also need to create belonging and to give love. That is there. That is as if it is the well of the true self, you know, that the mystics talk about, as if that is what brings these waters up that Teresa of Avila talks about, the waters that come up and water the garden of your soul. It is a connect with that deep, deep-seated need. I wish to belong. I wish to be loved. I wish to create and foster belonging. I wish to love. And to do that in deeper and deeper senses is to create, to foster, to nourish intimacy.
As I listen to you there, I love so many different elements that you bring together and you expound in great ways. The first thing really is that intimacy is not a non-negotiable. It's actually an essential. It's part of what defines us, nourishes us, and brings us into the fullness of our being, of our humanity. The next thing is that it's distinctly embodied and relational, and we can't step out of the picture. In order to be intimate, we need to foster that with ourselves. And in fostering that with ourselves, it doesn't displace fostering it with another. Introduce that language as well of mutual reciprocity between two people, the notion of there being an infinite well within oneself and infinite well within another. And so in that sense, you know, people are often speaking about, well, you know, at what point do you get to know someone, or are you just taking it to a logical extreme? And so this language that you put on the table, contrasting these events, intimacy as transactional, is contrasted with the notion of intimacy as process and trajectory, and puts it on a continuum rather than a destination. I think that's tremendously healthy language. And by putting it on a continuum, I guess, let me step for a second into an abstract idea and let me know if it sits well with you and helps us with this exploration or not. I'm trying to think of how in spirituality we've largely developed language of denial, the denial of the self and the abandonment of the self. If I want to grow spiritually, I enter into things like fasting, which is to withdraw from food and not eat for a while. I enter into a night vigil. I withdraw from sleep and I try not to sleep for a night or two. I go to a retreat, meaning I step outside of my life and I go away. I go into a silent retreat. I withdraw from conversation from others. Chastity, I withdraw from sex and sexual relationships. There's a lot in spirituality that's all about the withdrawal and the denial. And yet if I take a step back and I look at that, I recognize that there's hardly any entering into. Where's the entering into sleep as a healthy part of spirituality? Where's the entering into sex? Where's the entering into food? You know, and so when I step back and I think about it, I think of things like God has given us appetites. Appetites can be fulfilled and appetites can be unfulfilled. And in all, and so food becomes an example of that. I need food to live. If I give myself to the excess, if I give myself to the appetite, if I'm given over to the appetite and it rules me, I want to eat everything and I become a gluttonous pig. That is a state of unhealth. On the other hand, if I take someone that is where food is withheld through economics or through maliciousness from someone, they get hungry, they starve. Again, that is a state of unhealth. If someone is unable to feed themselves, or they're unable to make healthy food for themselves, they're not able to be nourished. So in that sense, there's a balance between these extremes. There's a balance between not having, whether one is withholding oneself from something or something's withheld from them, or on the other extreme, if food is forced on you, if you're forced fed, that is very unhealthy for you. If you end up being a gluttonous animal and you just chow everything, that's very unhealthy for you. And yet the desire that is given, the appetite that is given, is actually a healthy one. It's a necessary one. It's fundamentally a part of what it means to be human. You know, there's that joke of someone that says, I trained my dog to not eat anything. And as soon as I succeeded, it died. It's particularly dark humor. but I often feel when it comes to spirituality, that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to train people more often than not into love as an abstracted agape kind of, I've got a universal love for everyone and everything, but I don't have this particular love for who is in front of me, or I don't have this particular love for myself. It's like saying, I want a restaurant that serves the best food in the world by giving it away, and none of us that make it get to taste it or be nourished by it. A lot of restaurants actually operate that well, I guess, but that's dark economics for us. But moving away from that, moving back to the idea that intimacy, people can give themselves over to an overindulgent pursuit of intimacy, which usually becomes transactional, and that's unhealthy. But people can have with intimacy withheld from them, and we see that in the adult years in the way that they struggle to relate to themselves and others. And in that sense, becoming a connoisseur of intimacy is about picking up our choice, and it's picking up opportunities to practice intimacy in order to grow. You know, so for instance, the person that starts preparing food for themselves that has grown up poor struggles, you know, like I'll use a personal example. I remember when I first started cooking for myself in my 20s, I never understood why other people, when they cooked mince, it was really so good. And when I cooked mince, it was dry and bland because I'd never cooked with spices and I never cooked with sauces, you know, and when they did,
it hits close to home too.
Yeah. So someone would invite me around for a meal and it'd be fantastic and I'd love their food, and I'd invite people around for a meal and they would never come back. And I just didn't understand. No one tells you these things. They don't tell you what's lacking. And so one of the things that I've done in recent years is start curating my own cooking and eating space, which leads to things like choosing not only when I have my main meal or my primary meals, but also what I eat and how I go about making it. For most of my adult life, I wouldn't even notice I'd get hungry, and then I'd be in a state of ravenous, and then I'd go eat whatever I had. When I got married, I wasn't the primary cooker. I'd eat primarily what my wife had made, and we taught our kids to cook, and I'd cook occasionally. But for the most part, my relationship with food still remained unhealthy. I wouldn't think of meals ahead. I wouldn't notice. It would be a last-minute thing for me, even if I was cooking for everyone. And with braised, that's easy to get away with because you run out of the store, you get a pack of meat, you slap it on the fire. No problem. Ta-da. Look, I'm man. I make fire. I make meat. I do good. But when it came to other meals, I'd struggle because of that lack of preparation, the lack of thinking ahead. And so in recent years, what I've been doing is actually planning ahead and thinking ahead, rebuilding that relationship with food. You know, what do I want to eat, as is coupled with what feels good for my body, as opposed to, you know, for 15 years of my going into my adult life, I ate muesli and yogurt. It wasn't good for me. I'd feel uncomfortable from it, but I'd never bat an eyelid. That's food. Why would I get tired of it? It's purely functional. So to recapture that sense of flavor, of enjoyment, of process, has become a nourishing thing for me, and it's enabled me to connect with others in meaningful way as I prep good food and serve good wine and occasionally beer. Water too. But overall, you know, actually that process of building a relationship with myself through how I nurture myself has enabled me to start building relationships with others that are reciprocal in the ways that I nurture them. And so when you use that language and you speak of needing love and belonging and looking for it and asking for it and trying to find it and becoming a person who not only belongs and loves, but also creates and enters into fostering belonging and love for others. That's powerful language. Yeah. I mean, I'm really just regurgitating what you've said. So
No, but I love that. That really triggers a couple of things off in me as I listen to you, which is really helpful. Firstly, I laugh, I'll get to that, but I really enjoy, again, how you bring it to the personal and how immediate that is, that story around what it has been for you to, I guess, emerge in that space that I guess, in a way, I suppose, enforced denial that becomes then an ability to, you become your own custodian of that, I guess, as you tend towards health around, well, there are times that I'm okay not to eat and other times when I will enter into that deeply. And I love that, how you talk about curating your own eating space and moving into that and taking that seriously and hosting for yourself within just something as simple as food and then others. I think that's really beautiful. And I laugh because I can remember also being told, what is with this mince that you serve? Exactly that. It's so funny. What did you really think? You just throw some mince in a pan and then you put it on the fire and then you serve it. And that's so.
Absolutely. Why wouldn't you think that that's the way it happens?
Exactly. No one has ever taught me how to look after this for myself, how to pay attention, how to notice the importance of it, what it takes to do that. I think it's the same with love and belonging. Nobody ever taught me, oh, this is what it is like to go deeply into love and belonging, to receive and to give. And the receive and give, that's one of the things as well that comes out of that for me, is that there's nothing wrong with denial. There's nothing wrong with self-denial. There is an interplay between, you know, denying and enjoying, in the same way that if you were to say to me, like, what's really important in a relationship, listening or speaking, I'd say yes. Like, what's really important, spending time together or spending time apart? Well, yes. What's really important, giving affection or receiving affection? Oh, yes. That is the interplay between, and I think when there's too much of a focus, and I really resonate with that. You talk about a spirituality of denial that almost is a hyper-focus. There's a priority of, well, the true spirituality, and here by extension, we might talk the true intimacy would be self-denial. Only self-denial, only self-deprecating, only other-focused, only, and it reminds me, I was thinking, because I think a lot about needs at the moment in the work that I do, and there's a paradigm that I present almost weekly to people, which is there are four statements that we can make about needs. Three of them are unhealthy, and only one of them is healthy. The first is, my needs matter, and yours don't. So I receive, you give. That is the one-directional approach here. Number two, my needs don't matter, yours do. So I give always, you receive. The third one is, my needs don't matter, and neither do yours. There's actually a better third one than that that's kind of takes a little bit further, but those three are really helpful to just kind of think, well, neither of us, there's no real giving or receiving going on here, or there's only giving or only receiving, it's one way. And the further sort of permutation of that is a very passive-aggressive one, which is my needs matter, so do yours. No, wait, they don't. And that shows up sometimes in a relationship as well, which is very much the, don't worry, we both get this. Don't worry, we both get to get out of this. Oh, wait, hang on. No, you don't. It's a very harmful, very, you know, at its outer limits, it's very narcissistic, very malevolent kind of expression. You see gaslighting, all sorts of things happening there in relationships with that expression, which is kind of why I leave it off the table, because it's not, I don't think, that important right now. But what's really important to notice is it can't be just one way or not at all. So those are the first three. But the healthy one is my needs matter and so do yours. The difficulty with that is sometimes the needs are not so much in opposition. They're a little bit contrary. It's, I need to be listened to. Yeah, so do I. That's a very difficult, specific situation, you know, located in a time and place with two individuals. Well, I need to be listened to. So do I. Both of those matter equally. They both have equal priority. For that to work out, there has to be an interplay between denial and, for lack of a better word, indulgence. So there we have to start to negotiate around, what does it look like for both of our needs to be listened to be met? How are we going to make that work? Okay, maybe it's as simple as, well, I'll listen first, you speak, and then we'll take turns, and I'll get to speak, and you listen. And there I participate within myself in the denial and the indulgence, because I deny my need to be listened to in favor of yours. But it doesn't eclipse the other. Those both still sit side by side. And so what I'm trying to coach often is that there are immediate moments where you're going to have to move into self-denial, because true intimacy, again, the trajectory, is not attainable without self-denial, because we can't broadcast at the same time and listen at the same time and think that that's effective. That process-wise, that doesn't work. But long-term trajectory process-wise, it doesn't work. If only one listens or only the other listens or neither do, then we don't move into love and belonging. We don't move forward into what might be intimacy. And I think it's probably the same in the self. In my relationship with myself, there are moments when I notice, actually, what might be important for me now, tonight, would be to forego some hours of sleep, to push into that vigil. Exercise is a fruitful experience of pain. I tear the muscle. I push my body. Why? Because that's actually good for me. But too much exercise is very dangerous. Too much food, too little food. And those are very sort of practical things, but too much indulgence for my own listening to myself can actually be dangerous, because I can build an echo chamber. I can easily fall into victimology when I sit within my own self, when I don't allow feedback coming in from the outside. But if I never listen to myself, if I can never sink down deep within myself and locate that voice that is an echo of my true self wanting to come forward and speak, and can eventually be less of an echo and more of an actual connection with the voice that says, hey, this is who you are, oh, then it's equally dangerous. So it is, cliched, a give and take. It is both matter at the same time, and the opportunity, which is part of the all relationship is risk, is to figure out, okay, how can we do that at the same time while taking turns? That's the paradox. And that's what really strikes me as I hear you talk about that, because a spirituality that is only self-denial misses the beauty of the embodiment of, oh, it's also self-indulgent. And I know that's a dangerous phrase, and I pick my words very carefully because I mean to be a bit provocative. Because I think that really rattles the cage towards, oh, okay, what does it mean to hold this balance between self-indulgence and self-denial in a beautifully healthy way? Because if I can indulge myself and I can deny myself, I can participate in this sort of paradoxical thing, this balance thing, this give and take thing in my expression, in my search for and my expression for intimacy with myself. that can really unlock, if I can be gentle with myself and sometimes a bit harder with myself, if I can give and sometimes say, hey, wait for it, work for it, I can notice that's also what it takes in relationship with others. Sometimes I can say to them, hey, wait, I need to go first tonight. And that might be difficult, confronting, painful, but I need to hold that and say, hey, I want to speak first. Can you listen? And at other times I can notice, oh, yeah, I think I need to listen first. You speak. It'll be good for me, good for you, good for us. And we have to be able to hold that interplay. And I think our spirituality has to help us towards that in our self-intimacy, intimacy with other. And then I wonder, what is it in this, wow, the self to divine? Do we say to God, no, God, wait, I need you to listen. Wait, actually. And I can own that without feeling selfish, self-centered, any of the easy, right, the easy things that come up quickly. No, you can't. But to be gentle, wait, hang on, what's that can't? Is that the unearthing of a need that's too hard to touch, too tender, but it's there, it's real? In the same way that we get reactivity in, you know, the love, belonging, attachment stuff that's within people. Hang on, let's be gentle and just go, what's underneath that? Oh, maybe I can be brave and say, God, stop, wait. Maybe that courage unlocks a dynamic in which we already experience God might actually be waiting, and it is our projection. You know, and I think that's where it's interesting to notice the actual relationship of God versus the faith thing, right, that tries to handle both sides. We can break through and we notice, huh, as I am bold enough to embody my need and say, God, wait, it opens the door to experience perhaps God already waiting and strips away a level of projection. Who knows? I push back and God allows God to be pushed back. And I actually experience saying, hey, I need this, that space. Can you listen? I want to talk to you. I need to feel this. Can you deny? You know, I think of the self-denying God, the emptying God that also empties but embodies, that shows up in personhood but creates space. That I, if I'm really vulnerable, I think, I have limited experience of that, but that's a very strange and tender space for me to move into, to trust that I might experience the actual self-emptying God. I find that far easier from a faith position, actually, to be very honest. The idea of the Jesus coming down, blah, 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 blah. That actually takes a lot for me to step forward in my own need, to be clear with my own self-indulgence, and to risk asking God if that's the experience we're having in the person-to-person relationship. Would you back off? Would you allow me to speak? Would you even move with my pushing? That's quite a vulnerable, awkward space for me, actually, as I think about it.
That is, and thank you for saying that. I feel that something that is left out is we've got this myth of the Garden of Eden as being paradise, and paradise was lost. Adam and Eve enjoyed God's presence 24/7, 365. And then they messed it up and they were denied it. But right from the start, God coming to visit them and walk with them in the garden and leaving is a consistent thing. And in fact, I think a hermeneutic tool that I haven't seen or understood anyone to capture properly is the repetition of that throughout the book of Genesis, and of how individuals who either reject or turn to God is contrasted over and against communities that do or don't do the same. So there's that to start. And so that doesn't change. Like, that remains the same in this life for us as people. And I'd say that offers us the picture that God draws near to people and visits people and then leaves them, and God visits collections of people and leaves them as well. And I think that's something to tease out at another point. If I think of prayer is most often people getting together, discussing their needs or what's on the table, and then everyone taking turns in different fashions, either consecutively or on a topic or whatever, to basically talk to God and throw things out at God. There's often very little listening involved. There's very little waiting. There's very little reciprocal sensitivity. And in fact, in most situations, there's no expectation that God's going to respond in the moment, either to communicate or do stuff. God then does stuff out there by closing and opening doors, things working out, not working out. And either way, it's the will of God, right? And then I think the third thing I want to respond is say that so many pictures of God are pictures of God laughing at our plans, God using us for God's purpose, us living to glorify God, God wanting us to be faithful, but not God wanting us to be intimate. We've got to give up everything for God. We've got to pick up our cross. We've got to suffer. You know, we've got to do what Jesus did and lose our life for him and spend our life for him, et cetera, et cetera. But none of that is relational, intimate language. In fact, a lot of it is actually quite abusive. And when I think about it, and I think about a number of these faith statements that we inherit, that people like myself have inherited, and I'd possibly say you and many of our listeners, a lot of these, if we brought it into relationship that people have with themselves and relationship that they have with intimate others, they're actually quite unhealthy. You know, because we're always praying, meaning we're always talking, but we're not listening to God. And the picture that we're given is go to the Bible and then fill in the conversation for the other person. No intimate relationship survives and you're filling in the blank of the conversation for the other person. Even if you're getting it right, how does someone feel heard if you go, yeah, I know what you're saying and I don't need to listen to you? That doesn't work. But also, if you're expecting the other person to just spend themselves for you, to be there for you and to do your bidding, that's not relational. Like you can, in fact, if that's all you expect in employee relationships, that's an unhealthy work culture. And yet somehow we put that forward as being healthy in a faith environment. Yeah, I mean, I hope I haven't really gone off track, but I feel that there's...
No, I love that. No. That reminds me of that's my needs matter and yours don't from God to us. That would be an unhealthy... unhealthy statement of intimacy. It's not intimate.
And that's reinforced with the second one, that my needs don't matter, yours do. So I will give to you, God. You will receive from me.
Yes, the reciprocal. Yeah.
Yeah. And so we say that, look, there's give and take in this relationship, but what's happening is when we note the relational transactions is that they're unhealthy for two parties in two different ways because there isn't reciprocity in the giving and receiving. Both are giving up certain needs for the other. You know, God's need for glory and to be respected and to be worshipped matter. Our value as human beings don't because we're sinful and depraved and whatever. So God just receives from us. That's one unhealthy trajectory. Then in a whole nother category of our life, God's needs for intimacy don't matter or God's need to receive doesn't matter. You know, we just need to receive from God. You know, again, we're approaching different things. So in these different areas of our lives, we've got different unhealthy processes going together. For us to be receiving God in one area and giving to God in completely another doesn't create reciprocity in either, and it doesn't make it a reciprocal relationship.
Yeah, no, I like that. And in fact, only I think there's the guise of reciprocity because actually all we're doing is participating in a mutually reinforcing pattern. And that's the thing, is it takes two sides to mutually reinforce the one directional, my needs matter and yours don't. Actually, you need two willing participants because for there to be a relationship around that axis of, well, my needs matter and yours don't, there's someone who steps forward and says, mine matter. And there's another who steps forward and says, mine don't. That relationship doesn't continue without the mutually reinforcing what I call the dance often. That's the dance. It's the steps are there and the music is there and we just do it. And we have to realize, no, this is not working. So there is that guise of that. But yes, when you scratch the surface, you realize, oh, yeah, that's not reciprocal. It's just mutually reinforcing a one-directional thing. And I like how you point out both both directions of the one directional, in that God's needs don't matter, because I think that's a really good nuance to bring forward, because otherwise it's, I think the other is far clearer. We're sinful, we don't matter, whatever, it's all about God, you know. But on the other hand, I think that's more nuanced to notice, what about the God that creates out of love, perhaps even to be loved, to be in an intimate relationship, but doesn't receive that because we're so busy receiving, because God doesn't need anything. That for me goes against the, what am I, you know, carefully called the law of the relationships there. Like, my needs matter and so do yours. Okay. How can that look? How do we then chase intimacy so that we can experience that at a deeper and deeper level? What do you need to belong? What can I do that fosters your belonging? What do I need to belong? What can you do that fosters my belonging? Same for love. I think also of the area of, like, you know, if I think of revelation, of me disclosing myself, intimacy requires that. Intimacy asks for that. But I need to. That is my participation in intimacy. I want to be seen. It is something in terms of how I, so I talk about me, I, but I'm kind of somehow talking about the plural I. I, as a human being, wishes to be seen, wishes to be heard. And so I reveal, I disclose for that to happen. And I can, again, the me, myself, the intra relationship, is the foundation for that, because I can only reveal what I know there is to reveal, can only disclose that which I know to disclose. But I'm asking, receive, see, look, enjoy, welcome, notice, appreciate, be gentle, whatever it is in that. And that is also mutually reciprocal, the idea, okay, yeah, I ask you as well, be intimate with me, disclose, share. Tell me your story. Tell me what hurts. Tell me what's enjoyable. Tell me what's, you know, and I think this is where I often find that it's not the complete thing, but it is really helpful. Like, the sexual picture is actually helpful as an illustration towards, you know, if I took sex 101 with couples, it's, you're inviting, saying, hey, look, hey, please enjoy. Please tell me what you like. Tell me what is good for you. Disclose, reveal, share. Tell me your story. Tell me what's good. Do you like this? Do you like that? Do you not like this? Do you not like that? And that moves to be more and more intimate. The more that is done, the more there is disclosure, the more there is trust, the more there is welcome, the more of those things, the more intimate it can be. And yet at the same time, it can be a bit confusing or a bit misleading, because there is a perception, I think, that the physical act is intimate. Yes, to an extent. But actually, there's more than that. Much, much more than that.
I love that. You summarize it so well there as intimacy asks and seeks for self-disclosure. It to see, hear, and touch the other, for them to reveal and to disclose themselves to me. But it also asks self-disclosure of me. That another wants to see, hear, and touch me, that another is asking me to reveal and disclose myself to them.
That's why, to be crude, a strip club is not intimate, because it's a one-directional disclosure, right? Like, it's erotic to some extent, exciting, blow, whatever you might want to talk if you look at that, but it's not intimate. You know, let's not push that too far, because if you looked at an intimate couple relationship, that kind of physical manifestation could be quite intimate, but that's something completely different. It is that mutual, well, disclose and you disclose, right? A relationship that is very one-sided, where there is kind of share your story disclosure. We go on 10 dates, 10 friendship connects, whatever, and you're the only one ever telling me your story. Eventually, I start to notice within me, actually, I want you to listen to my story. But interestingly enough, the person always doing the telling, unless they're unbelievably self-absorbed and narcissistic, also starts to notice the lack. They also start to notice, oh, this is too much one way. This is too much about me. I also want to know you. Tell me about you too. And I think that sensitivity is there. And I think friendships, relationships, the dating thing, whatever it is that don't work is when it is too one-sided. And both the person who doesn't get to tell their story feels that, but the person being the only one telling their story notices, oh, this is not mutual. And there can be some shame. Well, why is it only about me? Won't they trust me to show me them? And there can be some frustration. Why is it always about them? Won't they ask me to show me them, that I show them myself? And so those don't break into intimacy because it isn't mutual. It isn't mutually enjoyable. It isn't mutually indulgent. And also there is not supported actually by a mutual self-denial, which allows the give and take to happen, which is the problem with narcissists. They have no problem with self-denial because it's just not on their plate. But anyway.
Well, we have certainly dived headfirst into this and covered a tremendous amount tonight. So I imagine there's a way to draw this to a close, but I'm not sure how.
We can just go for the awkward pause, or no, my sense is that this may develop into a two-parter. I still feel as though there's space for us to explore, but I'm also left with the sense of wanting to sit back a little and reflect after our chat tonight and consider perhaps two things. Is there anything that we covered that needs a little bit of fine-tuning, a bit more attention? And then the second is, where can we move to beyond that? And I'm very excited to explore further in terms of intimacy. And I think one of the ones for me would be some of the practicalities around what might it mean? Like, what does it look like? Perhaps for a practice? Maybe that's too sort of grand. But just to take a stab towards, what does it look like to lean into intimacy with myself, with another, and then with the divine? What do we need to focus on? I think coming out of tonight, for me, there would be areas of embodiment, presence. I can be present to me, I can be present to you, I can be present to the divine. But there's also a presence, is also kind of a resting in, a sinking into, I acknowledge, perhaps. Yeah, this is why we need to explore it further. But there's an embodiment. I think there's some practices around communication, noticing this sort of needs but access for me, I think, is quite important. I think understanding perhaps some of our own blueprints around love and belonging and what that might mean, and noticing that for me with another, that for me with the divine. There might be some similarities and some differences there. And I'm quite keen to look at what that might mean. What could that look like without, you know, trying to fully sketch out our relational spirituality and the practice thereof, but to look towards that. And perhaps some of the other aspects more specifically of the meet to divine with intimacy as well. So
I really like the way you put that. And I think we can open those up in a way that invites conscious participation and sharing, because I think, as we said a number of times before, we're not an answer show. we're on a conversational pilgrimage, and we're doing that with others individually in our own lives and on this podcast. There's easy answers that can be given. You know, we could give people a practice. You know, it's made of the following building blocks. Go and do that. But we're going a step beyond that to say, well, let's explore that. What does this practice look like for you and for me? How are we working it out? What are we finding to be valuable? Because there is a mixture of, you know, intimacy, I think, is a learned skill. It's something that we're taught primarily when we're unconscious and we're born, we're schooled into it. And then we become conscious and we realize that we're stuck within the mystery of what this is. And so for some of us, we claw our way out of it. For others, we fight our way into it. And others have just got the benefits of the healthiness of it. You know, so there's so many different permutations and nuances that even if we gave 10 different people the same explanation of a practice, it might come out in 20 different ways or 50 different ways, right? Because the practice is partly dependent on who you are as a person, where you're coming from, and where you're at on this continuum. So we're looking at a trajectory. So if there's a way for us to communicate a practice as a trajectory, I guess that's what I'd like us to explore.
I love that. I think that's so good because I think what you draw exactly on, and I'm probably just going to repeat you, but I like it so much. There's a nuance there around, let me put it this way, some of the sense of it is like the difference between information or formation. And so I love the idea that we could invite a listener to just be consciously present to what it might mean. No, let me say it this way. Every week, I try to talk to people about some guiding principles that have to be then in my language every week. I say, you've got to drag this down off the whiteboard into your life. Be present with you, with your partner, in your family, in your life, to what this is going to mean very specifically, because there's a very specific cocktail going on mixture in each individual. And so that's partly what I connect with. And you said, this is not an answers show. So I'll just go and sit here, walk there, breathe there, whatever. All of those things can be guiding principles towards what it might mean to really actually then go and explore what is intimacy with me. And for us to even take a poke at what might intimacy be for any listener with somebody else, we're already limited, I guess, in the medium because it's just you and I talking here. And I think to really achieve that means to would be to actually have a conversation with the listener, to engage in that mutual connection, that trajectory together towards some sort of intimacy around what is that for you? What is it for me? What would it look like? And there's some guiding principles. That trajectory thing is kind of a sense perhaps of what I hear you saying, which I'd love to explore. But then it has to then be real there in my life, your life with me. That's what I love about the conversational pilgrimage ideas. I think we're actually doing this in some way together. And also we do, you know, quite a segment of that offline, even just you and I. Yes, I look forward to explore that and see what that can give us. And what that might be for listeners. And I guess perhaps I would even then always want to sprinkle this in the end, but it just feels really, really important there as well to go, we love to engage with anyone who's listened and would want to have that conversation. Because I think there's something in that that is so special that you don't just get from a passive listening, that you can even not even get from a receptive listening, that is the you to me relational, interactive, conversational kind of thing. I don't know. It's still quite vague for me, and that's why I'm looking forward to exploring it further. But there's something so special there, so nuanced, so beautiful, that that's going to be really fun to dig in and see what's there. But it's been so much fun teasing some of this out and playing with some of these concepts and just thinking out loud with you and bouncing things off each other and hearing your thoughts. I think I would say again as well to end off, thanks so much specifically that you took it there first into the personal, into your own story, into the own embodiment of you, you know, and I think that's so special. That's been really lovely. Thank you.
It's a pleasure. I feel like I've really learned from you how to open up and do that in this context. So I've been a good understudy then.
Well, thank you. That's unexpected. That's nice. Thanks. I really enjoyed that tonight.